welcome to She's History. I'm your host, Laura Borsma. It's Pride Month. In this episode, writer and photographer Malika Ali Harding tells us about Pauli Murray. Pauli Murray was a civil rights activist, women's rights activist, lawyer, author, poet, and is amongst the first generation of female Episcopal priests. She's done so many amazing things, but why do a lot of us know nothing about her? We talk about how Pauli sometimes just missed the moment or wasn't put on display to help promote a cause because of her sexuality. Pauli Murray struggled with her sexual and gender identity, describing herself as having an inverted sex instinct. She had several deep relationships with women, and a number of scholars have retroactively classified her as transgender. You can read Malika's article about Pauli Murray on Puttylike. Let's dive in. How did you first hear about Pauli Murray?
I first heard about Pauli Murray from a good friend of mine's Instagram, Dr. Tama Bryan Davis. She's an amazing woman. She's a poet, a psychologist, and a minister and a dancer.
Oh, wow.
So she posted about Pauli, and then I felt a bit of shame because I thought I knew so much. I thought I know my African-American history, right? I'm like, well, who is this woman that I've never heard of? I have to look her up. And I was blown away by her life and how she could have been so influential in so many historical movements for Black folk, for women, quietly queer. She was an activist in the LGBTQ plus movement because she felt that she wanted to keep sexuality and gender. She thought it should be private because she was a part of that respectability generation.
Yeah.
And so I was really blown away looking at her story and then also learning that she held so many careers, which is always an inspiration for me because I switch and I think, what's wrong with me? Why can't I stick with one thing? But she was a poet. She was a lawyer. She was a priest. She, you know, was a human rights activist. She kept moving along careers based on what her passions were for whatever decade she was doing the work in.
I love that. Yeah, I feel the same way as you do. So tell us about Pauli. And I guess, yeah, let's start wherever you want to start. And then we'll dive in because it's true. Her story is amazing. I mean, what is her pronouns?
So let's talk about pronouns because her biographer says that in her lifetime, gender was binary. So this language wasn't a part of that we use now that's prevalent today. Was right. Not really common when Pauli was alive. But so in the article that I wrote for Pauli, I use they, them in there. But for our talk, I would say Pauli Murray. I would say she, her, because she was very proud of her activism for women of all classes. And she, she addressed herself in the feminine in her later life. And in her early life and personal letters, she had lots of questions about gender because she didn't feel that she fit into either, you know, the feminine expression or the male expression. She wrote home that she felt she had an he-she personality and would ask doctors for hormone treatments that weren't available. And then she even asked a doctor to look for male genitalia to see if that was present in their body. So, but later on in life, she strongly identified as woman and was very active. And she was one of the founders of the National Organization of Women with Betty Friedan. Yes.
I feel like she was just so ahead of her time.
Yes. And I think sometimes that when you are ahead of your time, it kind of lends itself to a certain kind of obscurity because she did always come right before the moment, right?
So it's like, oh man.
Yes. Oh, before Rosa Parks, she was arrested along with a friend for, I say friend, but some historians believe that she would date a lot of women in college for refusing to move to the back of the bus. What's hilarious about this particular story for Pauli is that Pauli was from the South and she understood the dynamics of Jim Crow and segregation.
Yeah.
The friend that she brought along was Jamaican and from the North. And she thought that people of color from the South were weak for moving to the back of the bus. So she said, I'm not doing that, right?
Oh, wow.
So they get on the bus and her friend is refusing to move because it is hot in the back and there's gases and there's bumps and it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So they're refusing to move. So as soon as the sheriff came, the Jamaican friend passed out.
Actually passed out or pretend passed out?
Passed out. Like, she got so fainted. Nervous and aww. Fainted. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh no.
But they were arrested and it was witnessed by, there were a lot of very quiet members of the NAACP because you had to be for your safety.
Right.
There was a member of the NAACP who witnessed this going on, who was near the bus, and asked them for their name, asked Polly, because her friend was knocked out, for their name and information so they can get them some help.
Oh, wow.
They staged protests while they were in jail. They got food, better food for the people that they were locked up with. But the case ended up being dismissed, I believe, and we can check this out, because they didn't want the bus station didn't want to make a big deal about it. So,
wow.
But yeah, she, before Rosa Parks, Polly Murray was arrested for refusing to move to the back of the bus.
I mean, were there a number, because the Rosa Parks story, because Eric did his movie, uh-huh. It talks about how it was kind of orchestrated to get the photo and to be a bit of a PR stunt. And that's because of people like Polly and other people who have been arrested before. So
yes.
That, just leading up to that.
Yes, with Rosa Parks, it was definitely sort of state, like a part of this whole idea of gaining equal rights for African Americans was this idea of presenting us in the best possible light. Like, look, we're human, we're decent human beings.
Yeah.
And so then we should have access to any seat we want on the bus. We should be able to eat wherever we want to. So they were very careful to put people forward in the movement who were spotless, right? Because there was a teenager, I believe, who also refused to give up her seat, but she was like a hellraiser and she didn't fit the image that they wanted to portray. So there was a sense of PR with the civil rights movement in order to make things happen for us. They did what they had to do.
And I totally get that. And that, I think that's also part of the talking to other historians about just the early women's rights movement and why some of the white women were scared of having Black or minority women as seen, because they were scared, like, oh, well, that won't help our cause. We'll get there eventually.
Yeah.
But it is so much about the optics. I don't think they were right in that, but I think they were scared. So that was their decision.
There's a lot of ways that we scare one another. I was just listening to Polly Murray, who did have a long-term relationship with a woman, was afraid of the ways in which radical lesbian feminists would be perceived by the general public.
Yeah.
And wanted to sort of, like, you know, thought that that might be a disruptive force in actually getting things done.
Right.
There's all this way, these ways in which, yeah, we, in order to, like, move things forward, we silence the wrong voices.
I think it's not remembering that most people, there was another historian that was talking about just the end of slavery and what led up to the Civil War. And it's just, it was like what you said, humanizing people and telling the stories and just telling them in a real raw way. It's like, you don't have to put spin on it or just anything, just tell the truth about it. And people will take what they want to take, but just, if you just present the truth about it and just do it in a way that's just not trying to sway you one way or another, then that's going to present what the reality is.
Yeah.
It's tough. Storytelling is tough though.
Yeah. When you're saying this, I'm thinking of, because it has parallels to Polly Murray, the 1619 Project journalist, her name is Nicole Hannah Jones. She was just denied tenure at the University of North Carolina because white supremacist leaders in the state did not want her. You know, she did the 1619 Project was the big New York Times project that looked at slavery and the history of Africans being brought to America. She won, Nicole won Pulitzer Prize. She won the MacArthur Genius Fellowship.
Oh, wow.
She was promised the tenure track at this university, but because there was so much opposition to her work on the 1619 Project, the university caved and decided not to offer her tenure.
Wow.
Polly Murray, that was her first denial. She tried to go to graduate school at the same university, the University of North Carolina, and she received a rejection letter and saying, members of your race are not admitted to this university. So she appealed it, and the NAACP got involved again, and they researched the case. And once again, they couldn't take on her case because it wasn't rock solid. She had been living it, even though she was born and raised in North Carolina, she had been living in New York City. She went to undergrad in New York City. So they said, we can't take your case because we only do cases that we believe we can completely win. We don't have the resources to, you know, to gamble. So she was denied admittance, and that led her to law. She went to Howard Law instead.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then later in life, in her later years, they invited her back to give, they were going to give her an honorary degree from the university. But Polly Murray also was a big labor activist. She fought her entire life for workers' rights. And she basically was, even though she was in the professional class as a lawyer and whatnot, she would live basically above poverty. And so she understood what some of the challenges were for the working class.
Yeah.
So there was a labor dispute when she was supposed to get her honorary degree, and she tried to mitigate and help the university sort of resolve the issue, but they couldn't. And she said, I won't cross a picket line, so I can't accept the degree.
God, she's so amazing.
Yeah, she's incredible.
Well, let's go backwards a little bit and talk about her early life. So you mentioned that she grew up in the South.
She grew up in the South in North Carolina. She was orphaned pretty early. I think her mother died when she was about 5 years old. Oh. And her father shortly after was sent to a mental asylum.
Oh, man.
And yeah, so she was raised by her maternal aunt, Aunt Pauline, whom she's named after. She's named after her grandmother and her aunt. And so I think her parents had moved north, or we can check that. But her aunt moved her back to North Carolina. So she grew up with her maternal aunt and her maternal grandparents.
Okay.
She was born 47 years after the Civil War.
Yeah.
So they were still counting down the years from freedom when Polly was born. And they would have, you know, annual celebrations of the liberation in the country. Her maternal grandfather fought in the Civil War and chose to live down south because he thought that change was happening. And it had during the Reconstruction years. So he left the North where he was from to move to North Carolina because he thought that big change was coming to the state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I know, it's so interesting to just put it in perspective of time and those events and how it feels like it was a long time ago, but it actually wasn't really that long ago.
No.
It's just interesting how fast and how slow change can happen.
Yeah.
Okay. So then she decided to go to college. Because this was a time when college wasn't very easy for women and especially for Black women. So how did she actually get to college in the first place?
Well, she wanted to leave the South really, really badly. And she had relatives in New York City, and she had this idea that she would go to Columbia. She got to Columbia. Oh, nice. And Columbia said, we don't accept women. But you can go to Barnard. and she couldn't afford it. So she didn't. She went to, let's
Wikipedia it real fast. Hunter. She got a bachelor's of arts degree in English in 1933.
From Hunter.
She was one of very few students of color there.
Yes, she was. And she went to live with relatives in New York City who were, even though we talk about segregation in the South, New York City was also segregated.
Yeah.
There were places where people of color lived and there were places where whites lived, but Polly's family was very fair. And so Polly herself was on the darker side of, she was one of the darker people in her family, but a lot of her family members could pass for white.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. This particular family in New York City, it was more like a don't ask, don't tell policy. Mm-hmm. They lived in a white neighborhood and she lived with them, but because she was darker, her presence started to raise questions with the neighbors. So she floated in and out of their home, sometimes staying with them and then getting rooms and spaces with people from Hunter.
Oh man, that's tough.
Yeah, it was. But what's also fascinating, my favorite writer of all time is Zora Neale Hurston.
Oh, yeah.
And if she had gone to Barnard, she and Zora Neale Hurston would have been the first Black women together to earn degrees from Columbia, because eventually they let women. It was a few years later that they started giving degrees to women. So they would have both been there.
She was so close.
She was so close.
Like what you said, just missed it. Like just.
Just missing it.
Which is so, like, honestly, and to tell that story is so relatable because I feel like most of us feel that way when.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the life of the majority of the people.
But she did go. So then she went to law school.
She went to Howard University, my alma mater. Go Bisons.
But you had never heard of her when you were there?
I had never heard of this person.
That's crazy.
Never, ever, 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 ever. Did not know anything about her until 6 or 7 months ago, maybe 8 months ago, when I saw Tama's post.
To prep for this interview, I was looking up other articles. There's a New Yorker article that says the same thing. Like, why have we never heard of this person before?
Yeah.
This is completely insane.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I felt. Like, I felt shame that I didn't know. Like, how could there be so many? How could she have gone to Howard and I'd never heard of her? Yeah. So she went because of the denial at the University of North Carolina. She applied. It had her pivot, and because of her experience with NAACP trying to get admitted to UNC, she decided that she might be better off trying to get a law degree. So she went to Howard Law School. She graduated top of her class. She was the only woman that graduated the year she did. She started with other women, but most of them dropped out. And she experienced what she called Jane Crow.
Yeah, so she coined that term?
She coined the term Jane Crow because it was one of the first times that she really, she did because she was not allowed to go to Columbia already.
Right.
There was a lot of Black men in the university who belittled her ideas, who didn't think she can do certain things. And so she faced gender discrimination at Howard Law. But then there was also a great respect for her. There grew to be a great respect for her work because she would help other students. Like there was a student who was blind and so he would have temporary spells of blindness.
Oh, wow.
And they would study for their exams and nobody wanted anything to do with him. I know I'm laughing. I'm laughing because I laugh at trauma. So yeah. I'm not laughing.
No, but it's true. But that is so human too. It's so many levels. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so she ended up helping him with his exams. And that's how she ended up at the top of the class. She said, I realized that teaching helped me to understand the material a lot better. And that's how she graduated top of her class.
That's smart. That's true, though. Yeah, because you have to sort of understand it to be able to tell it to somebody else. So that makes sense. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, I love it, too. And I like that she got there by way of helping somebody, which is her whole life trajectory. So at Howard, in her thesis paper, she presented the ideas of challenging segregation in schools by showing sort of the psychology behind segregation and what it does to Black children.
Oh, interesting.
And But the classmates thought that was a ridiculous idea. They really believed that segregation couldn't be ended, that the best thing that you can do was to fight for more equitable establishments so that they would be kept separate, but that the Black institutions would get the funding that they needed and the support that they needed to be equal.
Wow.
So they laughed it off.
Be like two countries, essentially, or two worlds within the country.
Two worlds.
Wow.
It was, and it still sort of is two worlds.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So they just wanted, they wanted to fight to make their piece of the pie equal.
Yeah.
And they did not ever imagine that the United States could really, that there really would be this desegregation was necessarily possible at that time.
Yeah.
So they laughed, but it became her thesis paper. And so she submitted it, it was accepted. And later they used her paper as a part of the argument for Brown versus the Board of Education, which
is
segregated schools. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And she didn't know. She had no idea that they were using, but she found out decades later. And she's like, why didn't you tell me? And so when she left Howard, she wanted to go to Harvard Law to get a higher law degree. I didn't even know that there were different levels of law degrees.
I didn't know that either. I thought it's like, once you're a lawyer, then you just...
Yeah, I'm like, that means you're... But no, there's different, there's different levels.
Interesting.
So she wanted to go to Harvard Law so she can earn more money. And she applied and was denied because, her students, her fellow classmates told her, they laughed at her. They're like, Harvard Law. They were like, they accept Black people, but they don't accept Black women. So you're not going to Harvard Law. And she said, well, I'm going to apply. And she was friends with Eleanor Roosevelt. She had developed a friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt. So she applied and she was denied and she appealed. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president at the time. And he wrote on her behalf a letter saying that this person is brilliant and should be admitted. They called a meeting and they had... I guess there was some kind of, we can look this up too, but they had a meeting to determine whether or not they would make an exception for Polly Murray. And this is in her letter that she wrote, I would gladly change my sex to enter into the university. So she's playing with this idea of sexual fluidity and gender fluidity, even in her appeal processes. In her protest, but she wasn't admitted and she ended up going to law school at Berkeley.
Wow. Even with an endorsement from the president.
From the sitting president of the United States.
Wow. That's why. Yeah. Okay. Let's back up. How did she become friends with Eleanor Roosevelt?
I think from her activist days, we can look that up, but I think from her activist days.
Oh.
What does it say?
It says she took a position at Camp Tara, a she conservation camp.
Yeah. The first time she met her, but I don't think they became friends right away. But she was kicked out of that camp because the camp director thought that she didn't show enough deference and respect to Eleanor Roosevelt. So she got kicked out of the camp.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
And so then, how did they meet? Let's see.
Later, they had correspondence that changed her life.
She started writing her and complaining about things that the president was doing. That's how they became friends.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And Eleanor would write back. If you wrote her, I don't know if she wrote everybody back, but she wrote Polly Murray back. And they developed a friendship through these letters.
Oh, and she also, so Murray became active in the case of Odell Waller, a Black Virginia sharecropper sentenced to death for killing his white landlord during an argument. And she wrote to Eleanor Roosevelt on Waller's behalf. And then Roosevelt in turn wrote to Virginia Governor James Price, asking him to guarantee that the trial was fair. God, that's so crazy just to ask that the trial was fair. It's like, that should just be a given.
They still executed him.
Later persuaded the president to privately request Price to commute the death sentence through his correspondence. Oh, through this correspondence, Murray and Eleanor Roosevelt began a friendship that would last 2 decades.
Yeah,
till Eleanor passed away.
Yep.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. That's kind of awesome. That's really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. But for both of them, especially, like, I grew to really adore Eleanor Roosevelt.
Me too. Yeah. I feel like we don't know enough. And the fact of how she helped to start the United Nations too is such a great story.
Yes. Yes. She's amazing.
Yeah.
So they became close, and she would send letters when she would go on road trips. This Polly Murray, this is when she would get to present as masculine. So she would dress in as a sailor or in different, or wear suits and just,
really?
Yes. And so she would send pictures back to her family, and she would send pictures to Eleanor Roosevelt, and she would say, this is, I feel my most natural self like this.
I love that. Well, and because Eleanor Roosevelt also is, don't historians talk about how she also had a lot of like deeper relationships with women?
Yeah.
She might've also been bisexual, or.
It's believed so.
But it's just so crazy to think now that people are still uncomfortable or weird about sexuality. It's just kind of like, really? If you actually look through history, there's so many stories about people grappling with sexuality, and it's just learn a little bit more history.
Yeah. It takes time for people to evolve.
Yeah.
Yeah. It takes a minute. But even when I read about some of the ways that Polly Murray struggled with her own gender identity and sexual identity, a lot of the things that she attributed to, she didn't believe that she was a lesbian because she was attracted to feminine women. So she had these ideas that were sort of, that we would consider outdated about what it would mean to be a lesbian.
Yeah.
And then she felt that she was more male because she was attracted to roles that were traditionally given to men. So a part of it is, it looks like what was available to certain genders, what was available to women at the time made her feel like she didn't belong to womanhood, because women were denied a lot of different access to different roles, access to certain universities and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally get that. Like, I feel like, especially just growing, and maybe because I grew up later when women had, you know, more rights and rights to stuff. And I never understood as a kid, like, why is everyone just not equal? Like, how am I not equal to men, to boys? Right. Like, we're just the same. We're it's the same. So it's like, why is this even a question? Like, I just don't understand it.
Right.
Yeah.
And it had been a question.
It's still a question.
Yeah.
She went to law school. She went to two law schools.
She went to Berkeley, and she struggled a bit at Berkeley. Her mentor even said to her, I think you might, she said, I wonder if we have a poet on our hand who's trying to be a lawyer.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so she had to, I think sometimes when you get those kind of challenges and you really want something, you have to, you pull up. And so she pulled up to finish and got her second law degree from Berkeley. And at Berkeley, she was exposed. I think she lived in housing for international students. So she became acquainted with, she had this sort of like a mini United Nations, like at the university.
I love
and
that.
So I think she appreciated that time where she lived with people from around the world.
Oh, I love that. What year was that? Was that in the...
In the 40s.
Wow.
I love the 40s. I love the fashion of the 40s. Oh, yeah. Also, unfortunately, because of the war, there seems to be women were presented as tougher in the movies too, because they had to pull up and they had to do work, and that's where we get the head wrap and the
Rosie the Riveter.
Rosie the Riveter, yes. Yeah. So I like that era because of the way that women are presented in pop culture and what were the realities of the things that they had to do while men were at war.
She basically, so her law school professor said, you are a poet. You have this side.
At Berkeley. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she had been a poet, she started out, her first thing was poetry, and she was trying to find a way to write poetry and not be hungry.
I don't know how to do that today.
Yes. So she couldn't really figure it out. So that she would work a lot and try to find ways to write poetry. And she had encouragement from an accomplished poet at the time.
I saw that they talk about she published a poetry book and she also published two autobiographies.
Yeah, so she published Dark Testament and Other Poems, but that was, it says in 1970, but she did one before she went to law school too. So she started off writing poems and she very much wanted to be a poet, but she had to live. So her poetry wasn't paying the bills yet. So she always had this, poetry was always with her. Let's just say that. And it helped her. And this is what I tell people who only see writing. They don't want to write unless it makes them some money, but it was also very therapeutic for her. She processed a lot of trauma through writing poetry. She wrote about segregation. She wrote poems that reflected her work in activism. She shared her poems with Eleanor Roosevelt. There was, I'm trying to figure out his name, because there was a poet who really encouraged her.
That's so cool.
So her first autobiography, Proud Shoes, was written in response to another denial. She couldn't take a position at Cornell University because of her activities. They had went into her medical records and found out that she told her doctor she believed she was homosexual. And so she was about to be offered a position at Cornell, but it was at the height of McCarthyism. Oh, and so she didn't get the job. And in response, she wrote the memoir, Proud Shoes, about her family, because her grandfather fought in the Civil War and was very proud of it. And she talked about the lineage of her family and how American they were and how much they contributed to the country. And it was almost like a, how dare you say that I'm un-American and this is my lineage. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
So yeah. So she has the book of poetry. She has the memoir, Proud Shoes. And then she had her autobiography that goes through the majority of her life, but she kept secrets. Like she was in a relationship she writes about the person, Irene Barlow, I think, that she was in a relationship with, but she talks about it as a deep friendship. But before she died, she destroyed all of their correspondence.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because she believed that her sexuality was private.
Yeah.
And that it shouldn't be, that it wasn't anybody's business. So
how did they discover, how did some of her secrets come out? Was there notes or was there other correspondence that came out after she died?
Yes. So she kept every meticulous note. She was a pack rat. And she kept everything except for these letters from Irene Barlow. And so her medical records she kept, and she donated to a library. Schlesinger Library, I believe.
Okay.
So all of her records were donated when she died to a library. So like her biographer could go to the library. Anybody can go to the library and have access to everything that she donated.
Yeah, because I know a lot of historical figures will do that, which is nice. It's nice.
It's nice to have access to it. Yeah. So that's how people know, but she doesn't give a lot, you know, we don't get to the love letters. We don't get access to the love letters, but this relationship pushed her deeper in. Once her partner died, and they always kept separate residence because her partner took care of her mother, her partner's mother outlived her partner.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they always kept separate residences. But when she passed, she decided that she really should follow her calling into the priesthood and fight for women to be allowed to be priests in the Episcopalian church.
Let's talk about that.
So both her and her partner, they met at a law firm. I think her partner was like an administrative. She had an administrative role, but they were both very tough women, and they were attracted by both their love of the Episcopalian church and that they were tough women in this law firm.
Yeah.
And so women weren't allowed to be priests in the church.
In some church, they're still not.
Yeah, and some churches said, yeah, I have my friend Tama, the one who I found out is a pastor, and a lot of, you know, two of my children's godmothers are in the ministry, and there is a lot of discrimination, what women are and are not allowed to do in the church.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So she, when her partner died, she fought to have women become priests in the church. And she left her law practice to go and study theology as an elder, as an older student. She understands gender issues. She understands racial issues. She understands the working class. She understands queer issues, and she understands ageism. Because she went back to school as an older student, and she had to really like fight her way through. And so that was her tribute to her partner, her relationship with her partner, Irene, was to go back and fight for women to be leaders in the church and for herself to take up the mantle and the calling.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. She believed it was a calling because she was given the final rites for her partner and also the final rites for her aunt, her adopted mother, who was her aunt. And she said, I was called to do these things because I was present, but these were things that the priests would do. Right. And she said, here I am ministering to the dying. I think women can do this work.
I don't understand why women are kept out of it, but why can't priests get married and be men or women? And I wonder, somebody was saying historically it came down to money and property that the church just didn't want to share.
Essentially. Oh.
Yeah. Which makes sense. It all eventually just comes down to economics.
Yeah.
Like racism and sexism. Who is it benefiting?
Yeah,
exactly. I know she really did have so many lives.
Yeah, she did.
Working as a lawyer, and then also as an activist, and also as a poet, and as a writer, and as a religious leader. That's amazing. She was appointed by Kennedy to the Presidential Commission on the Status of Women in 1961. So she was pretty active with the feminist movement.
She was very active. She was a founding member of the National Organization of Women because they wanted to have the equivalent of the NAACP for women's rights. So she was heavily engaged in that movement. She also did, what is it, Reed v. Reed? She thought that the idea of what we would call gender, but what they called sex discrimination
Yeah.
So Ruth Bader Ginsburg used, again, some of Polly Murray's arguments to win Roe v. Reed, saying, making the racial and the sexual analogous.
Yeah.
In the argument.
Oh, yeah. Reed versus Reed, a 1971 Supreme Court case, for the first time extended the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause to women.
Yes.
Interesting. Why haven't we heard of Pauli Murray's name just with like the Mrs. America show, or when we hear about Gloria Steinem or all of these other major feminist activists? I feel like her name should be part of that too.
Yeah, I feel like it should be too.
Yeah.
There's this idea of Black women and erasure, like a lot of contributions from Black women are erased from history. And I think, I just wonder if that is a part of it. But I think also maybe because she was a multi-potentialite and multi-hyphenate, and she switched jobs so much. So like when Ginsburg went to court, Polly Murray was in theology school, and she asked her, you know, do you want to be a part of this? And she's like, no, I moved on to theology now. So, but wow. They used some of her arguments to win the case. But Ruth Ginsburg does give her credit, and she put her name on the cover.
That's cool. So what would you say, Polly Murray, like, what's the big takeaway from the story, and how do you feel like it resonates now, either for you personally or just within our society and culture as a whole?
Another friend of mine, an interdisciplinary artist too, named Kenyatta A.C. Hinkle, talks about this idea of the historical present, about how much, and that's why it just shook me when the 1619 Project co-founder was denied tenure. It reminded me of how much, what Ta-Nehisi Coates calls the struggle, like we inherit the struggle and we have to keep the work moving forward, and that it doesn't, even in reading her autobiography, it kind of hurt my heart that so many of the issues that she faced are so valid today.
Yeah.
But then it also showed me how much change has happened with the idea that during the Great Depression, so many people were hungry, and that we do have some sort of welfare safety net so that people don't have to starve. Reading her story, I learned about how many children died hopping freight trains and how dangerous it was, and that we have greater protection for children in the country, that women can go to university. Oh my God.
I know.
We can be educated. Who knew?
You know, isn't that crazy?
Yes.
We didn't even have an option 100 years ago. Not even an option.
Yeah.
It's so crazy.
So her life reminds me that I have to do my part of the work so that the future generations can have a better life, to have the opportunities that some of the opportunities that I have now. I still fight for greater access for the ones who will come after me.
Thanks again to Malika Ali Harding, and thank you all for listening.